You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. What exactly is the Iraqi response to Secretary of State Colin Powell's address today? We go next to Mohammed al-Dori, Iraqi's ambassador to the UN, as he addressed the Security Council.
The pronouncements in Mr. Powell's statements on weapons of mass destruction are utterly unrelated to the truth. No new information was provided, mere sound recordings that cannot be ascertained as genuine. There are assumptions and presumptions which all fall in line with the American policy towards one known objective. His Excellency President Saddam Hussein reiterated in his interview granted yesterday to former British Minister Tony Benn that Iraq is totally free of weapons of mass destruction, a statement repeated by numerous Iraqi officials for over a decade. Ongoing inspections have showed that previous allegations and reports from the United States and Britain were false. Iraq submitted an accurate, comprehensive, and updated declaration of 12,000 pages, including detailed information on previous Iraqi programs, as well as updated information on Iraqi industries in various fields. Mr. Blix confirmed in his statement to the New York Times on January 30th of this year that the inspectors did not ascertain any of the scenarios alleged by Mr. Colin Powell, in that Iraqi officials were moving prescribed material inside or outside Iraq, aiming at concealment. He confirmed that he did not find enough reasons to believe that Iraq was sending his scientists outside Iraq to prevent them from being interviewed, and that he had no reason to believe that President Bush was correct in his State of the Union address in saying that Iraqi intelligence agents were posing as scientists for the interviews. We would like to reiterate that Iraq encourages its scientists to submit to interviews requested by UNMOVIC and IAEA. The clear goal behind the presentation of the Secretary of State of the United States of false allegations before this council today is to sell the idea of war and aggression against my country, Iraq, without any legal, moral, or political justification. In return, Iraq offers security and peace, and reiterates on this occasion before the members of the Security Council its commitment to continue proactive cooperation with the inspector teams so as to allow them to finish their tasks as soon as possible and verify that Iraq is free of weapons of mass destruction in order to lift the unjust sanctions imposed upon it and ensure respect of its national security and ensure regional security by disarming weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, including the huge arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in Israel, in accordance with the provisions of paragraph 14, in accordance with the provisions of paragraph 14 of Security Council Resolution 687 of 1991.
Mohammed al-Dori, Iraq's ambassador, addressing the UN Security Council, he was speaking through a translator. To coincide with today's presentation before the Security Council, Secretary of State Colin Powell, retired British parliamentarian Tony Benn met with Saddam Hussein recently and conducted an interview. In this excerpt of the interview prepared by Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI, Hussein discusses weapons of mass destruction, alleged links with al-Qaeda, and the role of Iraqi oil in U.S. policy.
The first question is, does Iraq possess weapons of mass destruction?
This is an opportunity to reach the British people and the forces of peace in the world. There is only one truth, and therefore, I tell you, as I have said on many occasions before, that Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction whatsoever. We challenge anyone who claims that we have to bring forward any evidence and present it to public opinion.
I have another question which has been raised. Do you have links with al-Qaeda?
If we had a relationship with al-Qaeda, and we believed in that relationship, we wouldn't be ashamed to admit it. Therefore, I would like to kill you directly, and also through you to anyone who is interested to know that we have no relationship with Al-Qaeda.
In relation to the inspectors, there appear to be difficulties with the inspectors. And I wondered whether there was anything you could tell me about those difficulties, and whether you believe they will be cleared up when Dr. Blix and Mr. Bareda come back to Baghdad.
You are aware that every major event must encounter some difficulties. On that basis, it is not surprising that there might be complaints relating to the small details of the inspection, which may be essential issues as far as we are concerned, and the way we see the whole thing. It is possible that those Iraqis who are involved with the inspection might complain about the conduct of the inspectors, and they complain indeed. It is also possible that some inspectors, either for reasons of practical and detailed procedure, or for some other motives, may complain about the Iraqi conduct. Every fair-minded person knows that as far as Resolution 1441 is concerned, the Iraqis have been fulfilling their obligations under the resolution.
Many people believe that this present conflict is really about oil. And I wonder if you could say something about how you see the enormous oil reserves of Iraq being developed first for the benefit of the people of Iraq and secondly to meet the needs of mankind.
The consecutive American administrations were led down a path of hostility against the people of this region, including our own nation, and we are part of the Arab nation. Those people and others have been telling the various United States administrations, especially the current one, that if you want to control the world, you need to control the oil. Therefore, the destruction of Iraq is a prerequisite to controlling oil. That means the destruction of the Iraqi national identity, since the Iraqis are committed to their principles and rights according to international law and the United Nations Charter. It seems that this argument has appealed to some United States administrations, especially the current one, that if they control the oil in the Middle East, they would be able to control the world. They could dictate to China the size of its economic growth and interfere in its education system. And could do the same to France and Germany, and perhaps to Russia and Japan. They might even tell the same to Britain if its oil doesn't satisfy its domestic consumption. It seems to me that this hostility is a trademark of the current United States administration and is based on its wish to control the world and spread its hegemony.
Retired British parliamentarian Tony Benn speaking with Saddam Hussein. Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI prepared that report. The Hajj pilgrimage will climax this year on February 10th, a day before the Eid feast, when an expected 2 million Muslims will stand on Mount Arafat on the outskirts of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Raphael Kraft reports from Amman.
Tarek Hatameh from the Saudi Travel and Tour Agency does a final check of the passports of his customers in one of the last buses leaving the Jordanian capital's Al Abdelali Central Bus Station to Mecca, Saudi Arabia. About 40 passengers board the bus, one of the last carrying pilgrims to perform the fifth pillar of Islam, the Hajj. One of the passengers, sitting in the front of the bus, his face full of joy and excitement, grabs the microphone.
God, who made this vehicle available for us, is flawless. Please, God, facilitate this trip for us and keep us away from the evildoers.
His neighbor, with a white beard, is already covered with the hiram, the two pieces of white sheet that all pilgrims will wear while performing their Hajj.
I'm from Iraq. My name is Professor Mohammed Zaki Khadr, and going to Hajj this year, inshallah.
So you live in Amman, not in Iraq?
I live in Amman, yes.
Does some Iraqis are doing the Hajj this year?
Yes, there are many of the residents here in Jordan are going to Hajj.
And the Iraqi living in Iraq?
There are also some going from Iraq directly, but not too many.
Because of the current situation?
That's right.
The border is closed at the moment?
No. They go directly from Iraq to Saudi Arabia.
All Muslims are required to make the Hajj or pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in their lifetime, provided they have means to do so. The Hajj pilgrimage will climax this year on February 10th, when an expected 2 million Muslims will stand at Mount Arafat on the outskirts of Mecca. February 11th would be the first day of Eid al-Adha feast, when Muslims slaughter sacrificial lambs. With the US-led war on Iraq looming, the Saudi cabinet called for a peaceful Hajj. Last year, Saudi authorities deployed thousands of police and soldiers for an incident-free pilgrimage. Despite the neighboring crisis, Tarek Hatameh from the Saudi Travel and Tour Agency in Amman has seen an increase in his business.
It's okay, alhamdulillah. The numbers have gone up than the last years, and everybody is happy. Even that there's this crisis, you know about it, about Iraq, but it's not a problem for Hajj, because Hajj is a very thing, it's a very important thing for Muslims. Anyone dream to go to Hajj, and if he have the opportunity to go, he will go, whatever is there.
Along with Damascus, Amman is the main transit destination to Mecca for the pilgrims who can't afford an expensive direct flight to the Saudi kingdom. An approximate 10,000 foreigners and 30,000 Jordanians have left Amman to Mecca for a 22-hour journey through the Hejaz region. Ahmad Azian, 19 years old, comes from Malaysia. The cliché of the old pious man going to accomplish his ultimate duty is not true anymore. Last year, the average age for a pilgrim was 30 years old.
The only thing that we can think of when we perform Hajj is the unity of the Muslims all around the world, where they come from many countries, from Europe, from United States, Asia. They're wearing the same clothes. The God trying to tell us that Muslims is united in this sort of things. There's no differentiation between the rich and the poor when we perform Hajj. And the only difference between all the people who come to Hajj is the taqwa, which is your faith to Allah.
Many will sleep in dormitories, while others will enjoy intercontinental-like hotels using African porters when they'll be turning seven times around the sacred black stone in the Garden of Allah. The bus leaves as the muezzin of King Abdullah's mosque overlooking the central bus station called to the last prayer of the day. Like Ramadan, Hajj has become an unavoidable event for Western decision makers, making it unlikely that a war with Iraq will start before the Eid feast on February 11th. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Raphael Kraft in Amman.
Ashraf Nubani, an Arab-American civil rights activist, says democracy is not a reality in the U.S. According to Nubani, the power elite in the Arab world have alliances with those dominating the U.S., and the people's struggle for power is the same. During the Wilson High School student walkout in Washington, D.C. recently, Nubani spoke to Peace Watch producer Reem Kathuda and compared activism in the U.S. and the Arab world.
When I was a professor at Michigan State University's, there were issues like apartheid in South Africa, Zionism, and the war in Vietnam, and students' rights and civil rights. They may appear as if they are separate issues, but they are the same issue. It's about justice. It's about empowerment of people. I feel comfortable doing activism and human rights here in the Arab world. I mean, to defend the right of black Americans or Mexican Americans to vote is not different from organizing to have genuine democracy in Egypt or in the Arab world. It is one and the same issue. And the power that's behind domination in the United States has alliance with those who dominate us in the Arab world. I feel a unity of purpose and a unity of struggle.
In the United States, there was more of a right of assembly. There is the First Amendment, right of a free expression.
The Constitution is great, but the application of that Constitution varies from time to time. You cannot say that the level of democracy during McCarthyism is the same like it was in the 60s, or you cannot say that the level of democracy and right of disagreement and dissent under Ashcroft's administration is the same like under Ramsey Clark administration in Johnson's period.
Ramsey Clark actually was during the McCarthy era.
Yeah. Democracy in the United States in principle is there, but the application of that democracy varies from time to time. And also, when we speak about democracy, democracy for whom? I mean, black Americans were deprived from voting until very recently. Even in the last election, the voting hindrance of people going to the voting booths and so forth is reminiscent of what happens in our country. In our country, of course, we lack democracy, but that does not mean that we prescribe to democracy a la Thomas Friedman. The British colonizer, when came to Egypt, came under the pretext to protect the minority rights. Of course, the actual purpose was very different. And the same thing here, we hear the U.S. Administration speaking about democracy in the Arab world, while actually an idiot would realize that the purpose of the imminent attack on Iraq has something to do with oil, and I wouldn't say national interest, because national interest means the interest of the bulk of the American people. I think this war is against the bulk of the interest of the American people, but it actually feeds the interest of the huge corporations, military corporation, arm industry, oil industry, and advanced technology industry, and it serves the interest of a thin slice of the American society. The trouble is that the awareness of the bulk of the American people is still not acceptable, even though we see youngsters demonstrating, which is really a positive sign. But yet, thanks to the corporate media, which prevents the people from listening to the other opinion, if there is democracy in this country, there should have been a debate in schools and universities about the issues, for heaven's sakes, a debate in the Congress. And in that sense, I agree with Senator Byrd, who says that it is Bush who is actually not abiding by the Constitution and by the law.
How would the Iraqi people get rid of Saddam Hussein? Because clearly a lot of them are not satisfied with him.
Of course, we have problems and we have dictatorship in our part of the world. But we have to put things in real context. Saddam Hussein and his regime was the darling of the U.S. administration at one point when Iraq was confronting Iran. Those people who criticized the Iraqi government, like we did, I am a vice president of Alexandria Human Rights Association, we issued a statement after Halabja, when they used chemical to fight the Kurds. We are aware of the negative aspects of the Iraqi government, but Halabja didn't happen yesterday. It happened in 1988. And the administration at that time even quenched the Congress from taking a stand against the Iraqi government in relation to Halabja. The picture is very clear. It is interests of the big corporation that rules, not principles like democracy and human rights. It's very interesting that there is a notion that the more American officials talk through Arab media, that the Arabs will be convinced. Actually, the more they talk, the opposite result, because they can see through the lies and the twists and the double standards, because they see how the United States administration treats Israel, which has an arsenal of nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons, and yet they are trying to attack Iraq on the pretext of weapons of mass destruction.
So you're saying that for the Arab region, there is no fear that Saddam Hussein is a threat?
No threat at that level, but there is disapproval of Saddam's policies as far as democracy and the human rights. But I can tell you, because of the aggression of the United States administration against the Arab world in general, Saddam Hussein is a hero in the Arab street. Any leader in the Arab world who defies the United States government policies becomes a hero.
In tangible terms, what does the common Egyptian suffer that he or she relates to United States imperialism so that Saddam becomes a hero?
The most important thing is the policy towards Israel and the support of a vicious regime that is committing daily crimes that the common person sees it on television, and the attacks on Sudan, the attacks on Iraq, and the lie about prosperity that they expected when they signed the Camp David Agreement, and the lie about peace that was awaiting the Egyptians if they signed the Camp David Agreement. Now they see that Sinai is demilitarized. They see that Israel has a free rein to attack Lebanon and to attack Iraq like they destroyed the nuclear reactors there, and to threaten Syria and to threaten Egypt. And the economy is in shambles and there is no democracy. And also the attack on Afghanistan is one thing to be against Qaeda people and terrorists and so forth, but now there is occupation of Afghanistan and people are against it. That's why they oppose the United States policy.
In closing, what would you like to tell our listeners?
Corporate media misrepresent the news. The person who wants to know have to ask questions why American policy towards Israel is different from American policy towards Iraq, why the United States government did not oppose the use of chemicals in Halabja, expose the double standards of the United States administration. They have to realize that war is against their interest. It takes away money from education, from health, from programs for the elderly. It is in the interest of a thin slice of wealthy American.
What do we want?
Ashraf Nubani, retired Egyptian-American professor from Michigan University. Thanks to Reem Kathuta, Peace Watch's producer for WPFW, for that report. First Lady Laura Bush had scheduled a symposium at the White House on the poetry of Emily Dickinson, Langston Hughes, and Walt Whitman. A number of renowned poets were invited to attend. Sam Hamill, founder of Copper Canyon Press, was one of the invited poets. Hamill, author of 13 volumes of poetry, has taught in prison for 14 years and worked extensively with battered women and children. Hamill not only declined the invitation from Laura Bush, but called upon other poets to write poems in opposition to the impending war in Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with Hamill yesterday about his response to the First Lady and about what motivated him to decline her invitation.
Well, as a practicing Buddhist, I'm opposed to war across the board. I understand that's an extreme position in any culture, and particularly extreme in this culture. But in this particular instance, we've gathered about 3,500 American poets together who cover the whole broad spectrum of opposition to the Bush agenda. Some people would like the UN to run its course. Some people are flatly opposed to war, and most people fall somewhere in between.
Now, recently you and many other poets were invited to the White House by First Lady Laura Bush. What was your first reaction when you received that invitation?
That empty, sinking feeling, because I knew perfectly well I could not go to the Bush White House, and if I did go to the Bush White House, I would not be welcome.
Yet you had an invitation.
They had invited me.
Yes. Why did you feel you wouldn't be welcome?
I'm an outspoken critic of this administration and its policies. It's inconceivable that I would go to a Republican White House.
How do you suppose your name got on the invitation list?
I expect somebody made a very serious mistake. And I think this speaks volumes about the quality of White House intelligence. I've been a political activist for 40 years.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're even offended that you were invited.
I'm not offended at all. I think it's wonderful. But I also think it was a huge mistake on someone's part, and I expect that someone's probably now looking for a job.
Now, subsequently, you wrote an open letter asking poets, not only did you decide you weren't going, but you wrote an open letter asking other poets to write poetry against the war, the impending war with Iraq.
Or simply to make statements of conscience, because one can't simply produce a poem on demand. Well, first of all, I don't know really a single poet in America who supports this administration and its agenda.
Not one?
Not one.
Oh, come on.
I honestly don't know a single poet in this country who supports this administration. Poets tend to be humanists, and we tend to not think in ordinary political ways. And expediency is almost never our solution to any given problem. So I asked my fellow poets if they would be inclined to send me a little poem or a statement of conscience and promise to deliver these to the White House on February 12th.
And how many responses did you get?
So far, about 3,500.
Okay. A sizable. Were you surprised by that response?
I've been astonished by that response. It's also become kind of an international movement now. There's going to be poetry readings all over the country and also in Canada and England and Japan on February 12th, honoring Mrs. Bush's appreciation of poetry.
Now, February 12th is the day that you were invited to the White House. Do you know if that event is going to take place?
That was canceled about 2 days after my email went out.
Was it because of your email?
Absolutely.
So
I didn't intend to close down her program, by the way. I simply wanted to provide an opportunity for my fellow poets to be heard. It was a symposium called Poetry in the American Voice, and they were going to discuss Walt Whitman and Langston Hughes and Emily Dickinson. And I thought it particularly ironic that, given the history of Whitman and Langston Hughes, that they would cancel this program out of fear of what poets were going to say.
Well, we read where it was canceled because they were fearful that it was going to be politicized.
How many American poets are more political than Langston Hughes and Walt Whitman?
Maybe it's
all
the type.
All poetry is political, really. It's poetry is a social voice that that comes from a very solitary place. But it is a social voice, and it carries with it a lot of political baggage.
If Laura Bush thought that there would be poems, God Blessing America, and Speaking to the Patriotic Spirit, that
those
perhaps
politics
the event
would be welcome.
Yes.
But they know perfectly well that there are very few poets in this country who are inclined in that direction. A number of poets intended to go. Naomi Shihab Nye, I think, also intended to go. Quite a number of poets I've heard from were invited and declined the invitation, including people like Galway Connell.
And some actually sent you poems, did they not?
They all did, as far as I can tell. They're being downloaded and organized on our website at poetsagainstthewar.org.
Sam Hamill, founder of Copper Canyon Press, will have some of those poems for you tomorrow. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer today was Scott Gurian. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Reem Kathuda, Sam Silsby, and Chris Harlan. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.